Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and Modern Israel. This is session 14 in our section called Israel Present. Let's do a quick review of where we were in our last session. Last session, I started with Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion's statement, "In Israel, in order to be a realist, one must believe in miracles." That's because Israel is a miracle country. You can't explain the existence of the nation of Israel humanly. It's not something that just happened because of human skill and human cleverness. Israel is a miracle country, a country that exists because of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, well, let's move on. Now, this country formally came into existence in 1948 with the proclamation of the State of Israel. The British terminated the mandate and then left the nation. David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence. The Palestine Post published this very famous headline, "The State of Israel is Born." Notice it was called the Palestine Post then and is now called the Jerusalem Post. And the U.S. recognized Israel on May 4th, 1948. Immediately, the United States recognized Israel. And immediately, six Arab states invaded the nation. From the south, Egypt came in from the south. On the east, the Jordanians. On the lower east. Then in the middle east of the country, Iraq. And then in the northern and east border of the country, Syria. And then to the north and to the northwest, the Lebanese armies came in. So the new nation immediately came under attack. One of the more important battles is the Battle of Kibbutz Yad Mordechai. As the Egyptians came up the south, up the southern coast, they encountered this stubborn little kibbutz, Kibbutz Yad Mordechai. And Yad Mordechai held up the Egyptian advance on Tel Aviv to such an extent that Tel Aviv did not fall to the Egyptian armies. The battle for Jerusalem was a bit different, however. The old city did not hold out. The new city did. The old city fell to the Jordanian legion. And this is a picture of Jewish refugees fleeing the Jewish quarter of the old city when it fell to the Arabs. And then Jerusalem found herself under siege. The main road from Jerusalem to the coast was cut off. It was cut off starting at Latrun. Latrun is the location of the police fort. Very formidable opponent there. So from the police fort at Latrun, the road on the Deir Ayub section of the road was cut off. And no supplies could get into Jerusalem. But Colonel David Mickey Marcus had a solution. Again, here is Jerusalem under siege, and this is the Deir Ayub section of the road that the Arabs totally controlled and prevented any convoys from advancing up the road to Jerusalem. But to the south of the road, there was a footpath that Colonel Marcus was infiltrating foot soldiers into Jerusalem, bypassing the Deir Ayub section of the road. And he speculated that that footpath could be turned into a road, could be widened and turned into a road that trucks could pass on. He was given permission to do so, and so the Burma Road, as it came to be known, was then constructed, bypassing the Deir Ayub section of the road. And here is a picture of the building of the Burma Road. And eventually the Burma Road was finished. It was finished just in time. And trucks with material and food, water, could then convoy along this narrow, dangerous road and enter Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was resupplied and the new city survived. Well, the first United Nations truce fell upon the battlefield and both sides began to rearm. Here is Israel with one of her fighter aircraft. She also acquired some Spitfires and some more heavy weapons, the Sherman tanks, this Cromwell tank. So both sides were ready when the truce ended. The status after the first United Nations truce is shown in the black here. The Israeli areas are in solid black, and the Israelis initially lost some territory to the advancing Arab nations. But then the Israeli offensive began. Here are some Israeli forces in action at Kibbutz Negba. Moshe Dayan's mechanized squad, his mechanized units, captured the Lida airport. And eventually a second UN truce fell upon the land. But now the status of the second United Nations truce was a bit different. The Israeli areas were now in solid black and in dark gray. So the Israelis have gained quite a bit of territory. All that dark gray territory is now under Israeli control. And the next step was to liberate the Negev, the south of Israel. That was done with Operation Horev. And Operation Horev was so successful that Israel actually penetrated into Egypt proper. And so this territory, this is the territory occupied by the Israeli forces from which they were forced to withdraw during the early months of 1949. They had actually penetrated into Egypt. And all the area there, the black area, the light gray area, and the dark gray area are now all Israeli occupied. And this picture is a picture of the raising of the flag after Operation Uvda, which was the capture of Eilat, the very southern city in Israel. This was the last campaign of the IDF in 1948. In 1949, ceasefire agreements were signed with Egypt, Lebanon, Transjordan, and Syria. And this is the armistice lines from 1949 to 1967. Israel is in the blue. The Jordanian-occupied territory is in orange, and the Egyptian-occupied territory is in red. We call the Jordanian-occupied territory the West Bank today, and we call the red Egyptian-occupied territory the Gaza Strip. But notice, the Israeli territory is quite a bit more than what the United Nations resolution had outlined. If the Arabs had just left Israel alone, they would have had a Arab country that was quite a bit bigger than what was left. So here, the Israelis had gained quite a bit more territory. And in fact, this is the formal armistice agreement with Jordan. Again, Israel is in the blue area. Jordanian-occupied territory is in orange, and Egyptian-occupied territory is in red. And please note, there is no Palestinian country there. There's no Palestinian state exists at this time. It is Egyptian-occupied territory and Jordanian-occupied territory and Israeli-occupied territory. The Palestinian state would not come into anyone's mind until a number of years later. The UN then accepted Israel as a member nation. The first prime minister was David Ben-Gurion. The first president was Chaim Weizmann. Knesset and government were functioning, and this is the modern Knesset building where the government operates. And then came the immigration problem. 340,000 immigrants came into Israel from Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Now, probably the most famous influx of refugees was the airborne transfer of some 50,000 Jews from Yemen to Israel. Now here's a map of the area. Yemen is the very southern tip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and 50,000 Yemenese Jews were flown to Israel in Operation Magic Carpet. Operation Magic Carpet. And that brings us to the new material that we're going to explore today. This brings us to 1950, and the fact that the Western powers guaranteed the existing borders of the Middle East. Now, the preamble to all the Rhodes Armistice agreements made very impressive and encouraging reading. Each agreement stated that it was designed to facilitate a transition from truce to a permanent peace. Each armistice agreement endorsed a Security Council injunction against the use of force and affirmed Israel, as well as the Arab nations' rights to security and freedom from attack. However, in spite of the high-sounding statements, the Arab countries adopted a hostile policy toward Israel. The Arab purpose was single-minded and all-absorptive. It was flatly committed to the destruction of Israel as an independent state. And so the question we have to ask is, has anything changed even today? Well, I'll show you two fairly recent headlines that show nothing has changed. This is from the Times of Israel in May 2nd, 2014. The headline read, In Italy, Al-Aqsa Mosque Imam urges the destruction of Israel. That was just a few years ago, hasn't changed. And in the Tower magazine in 2014, Hamas chief, "We will not make any compromises on the destruction of Israel." And this is 2019. Today, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. Now, the armistice agreements were originally to be but one phase of a twofold effort under the United Nations to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. By the terms of the General Assembly resolution of December 11, 1948, a Palestine Conciliation Commission, the PCC, was established and charged with three major tasks. Task number one, the accomplishment of a binding peace settlement between Israel and its Arab enemies. Two, the facilitation and measures to repatriate and resettle Palestinian refugees. The facilitation of measures to facilitate Palestinian refugees. Now note, there was no need to resettle Jewish refugees. Israel was doing exactly that, taking in 340,000 refugees from the Middle East. What was happening on the Arab side of the coin? Nothing. Nothing. So measures to repatriate and resettle Palestinian refugees went nowhere, and nothing has changed even today in 2019. The first task, a binding peace settlement between Israel and the Arab enemies. The second task, resettling the refugees. And the third task, the formulation of a plan to organize a permanent international regime in Jerusalem. Notice, they wanted an international regime, not a Jewish Jerusalem, but an international Jerusalem. Why? Well, because Jerusalem still is suffering during the times of the Gentiles. We're still being trodden down by the times of the Gentiles, and we will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the coming of the Messiah. Well, as matters developed, the PCC failed. Not only did it fail to achieve task number two, it failed on all three. It did not achieve any of these goals. Subsequently, the Arab nations adopted a fourfold strategy against the young nation of Israel. The Arabs attempted to strangle Israel's capacity to survive and grow through four means. Number one, economic boycott. Number two, blockade. Number three, diplomatic isolation. And number four, border violence. And again, I ask, has anything changed? No, today we're in the midst of the BDS movement, the boycott, divest, and sanction movement, trying to strangle Israel's economy. Again, it is not working, but the attempts to strangle Israel are still going on. So the region in 1950 was unstable and ripe for war. So not much has changed, has it? Now, the West took the first decisive action to restore stability to the Middle East. In May of 1950, the United States, Britain, and France issued a declaration. Should the three governments find that any of these states, that's Israel or the Arab neighbors, if any of these states contemplates violating the frontiers of armistice lines, they will act, both within and without the framework of the United Nations, in order to prevent such a violation. Now, this gesture reflected Western self-interest because it was primarily designed to block Soviet penetration into the area. It was nevertheless greatly received and welcomed by most Israelis. All right, now we come to the law of return. Now, the first Knesset passed a law of return in July 1950, investing Jews everywhere with the legal right of immigration to Israel. In David Ben-Gurion's words, this is not only a Jewish state where the majority of the inhabitants are Jews, but it is a state for all Jews, wherever they are, and for every Jew who wants to be here. This right is inherent in being a Jew. Well, for all its impressive language, the law of return did not grant citizenship. In 1952, the Knesset passed a nationality law that accomplished that purpose. Under the 1952 law, Israeli nationality might be acquired by four ways. Number one, by immigration. Number two, by birth. Number three, by residence. And number four, by naturalization. But the law of return likewise failed to define the term Jew. Who is a Jew? The Supreme Court accordingly made its first effort to define this term in the Brother Daniel case of 1958. Oswald Rufeisen was a Polish Jew who had taken refuge in a Polish monastery during the war. He became converted and took orders as a Carmelite monk. He adopted the name Brother Daniel. Rufeisen still felt himself Jewish enough to immigrate to Israel to live and to work. And this is a portrait of Brother Daniel, Shmuel Oswald Rufeisen, Brother Daniel. So he claimed the right of entry under the law of return. When the authorities refused him entry, he appealed to the courts. According to halakha, that's Jewish Orthodox law, Rufeisen was indeed a national, an ethnic Jew, because he was born of a Jewish mother. However, the Supreme Court ruled that the national term Jew, while ordinarily applied to many who did not practice rabbinic Judaism, could not, quote, in the language of men, be applied to anyone who voluntarily adopted another faith. Now, here is the a book that you might be interested in reading, In the Lion's Den, The Life of Oswald Rufeisen. It's available on Amazon.com if you'd like to review his life. Now, what's the end of the story? Eventually, Brother Daniel, Oswald Rufeisen, was allowed to immigrate and become a citizen through naturalization. And naturalization means to admit an alien into the country as a citizen. So he was considered an alien even though he was born a Jew. Now, new regulations were added in 1960. Under pressure from the Orthodox religious parties, the definition of who is a Jew was determined by halakha. Namely, a person is considered a Jew if he's born of a Jewish mother, or if he has been converted to Judaism following Orthodox procedure and Orthodox standards. This Orthodox interpretation of nationality remained the administrative law of the land until January of 1970. Then the Supreme Court handed down a judgment in yet another historic case, the Benjamin Shalit case. Now, the outcome of the case was that the law of return was amended. It was amended to grant automatic citizenship rights to Gentile spouses, to children of mixed marriages, and even to adult descendants of mixed marriages. Now, until the Benjamin Shalit case, anyone born of a Jewish mother was considered a Jew. With the Shalit case, the qualifier to the definition Jew was added, and who is not a member of another religion. That's the phrase that everything turns upon. And was not a member of another religion. This is the phrase that impacts me personally and every Messianic Jew, because the rabbis consider placing your faith in the Jewish Messiah as another religion. Kind of ironic, isn't it? But that's the case now. And subsequent cases have turned on this phrase. For example, the 1978 Dorflinger case. Eileen Esther Dorflinger, who declared herself Jewish, was, in spite of her protest that she had not changed her religion nor left the Jewish people, she was a Jewish believer in Jesus, she was declared Christian by Bagatz, that's the High Court of Justice, and refused entry under the law of return on the ground that she belonged to another religion. The criterion was that the other religion, Christianity, would, on the basis of her own statement of her beliefs, and the fact of her baptism, and there's the key activity, and the fact of her baptism recognized her as a member of another faith. And baptism is very important, because before you're baptized, the rabbis will consider you Jewish. But after you're baptized, they will consider you a Christian. So that's a crucial act of obedience and identification even today. Then we come to the 1989 First Beresford case. Messianic Jews Gary and Shirley Beresford were denied their appeal by Bagatz on the ground that they too were members of another religion, a religion other than Judaism. even though the state of Israel does not recognize Messianic Judaism as a religion at all. Their criterion was that their faith in Yeshua as the Messiah and the Savior and the Lord included the belief that Yeshua is the Son of God and that God consists of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. These are doctrinal points incompatible with Rabbinic Judaism. Now, these points are not incompatible with Biblical Judaism. These points are very biblical, that God is triune in nature and Yeshua is the Son of God. He is the Savior. He is the Lord. That's very, very much consistent with Biblical Judaism, but it is totally inconsistent with Rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism that the rabbis have created. And also the second, the 1992 was the second Beresford case. Vagatz reconfirmed this decision on the same ground, and they also rejected the appeals of the Speakman and Kendall families to immigrate under the law of return. The court rejected all three families' appeals that they be granted permanent residence under the law of entry. That's immigration. That's Israel's immigration law for non-Jews. So they were not even allowed to immigrate under the law of entry. The court stated that the Minister of the Interior had the freedom to grant or not to grant permanent residence under the law of entry without giving a reason. But, quote, he could not act in a discriminatory way. Well, if the Ministry of the Interior does not have to give a reason or not accountable, so how can you determine the nature of the decision? They're not accountable for the nature of the decision. They don't have to give a reason. You can't tell if the reason is discriminatory or not. So this position simply gives the Interior Ministry an open hand to do whatever they like and to make whatever decision they want. All right, well, let's return back to 1950. 1950, we pick up the airborne transfer of 121,000 Jews from Iraq to Israel. Now, the immigration from Yemen soon was followed and ultimately surpassed by a massive airlift of Jews from Iraq. Now, on this map, you can see little Israel in the black there. It's totally black. And to the east is the nation of Iraq. Iraq housed the largest, oldest, and most distinguished of all Eastern Jewish communities. The population numbered approximately 130,000 in 1948. The circumstances for the Iraqi community began to go bad in the 1930s with Arab right-wing nationalism and a pro-German government. However, in 1948 and 49, during the War of Independence, Iraqi Jewry entered into its darkest hour. Under the cloak of martial law, the Baghdad government subjected the Jewish citizens to organized persecution. Jewish homes were searched, often pillaged. Hundreds of Jews were arrested and imprisoned under charges of treason. Jews were expelled from the government. Jewish doctors and pharmacists were barred from practice. Jewish students expelled from the university. Jewish banks ordered closed. Jewish merchants denied import licenses, so the community faced economic ruin. With the outbreak of fighting in Israel, immigration to Israel had been declared a capital offense. They didn't want any Jews to immigrate to Israel and strengthen the Israeli people. Nevertheless, the government was intrigued by the prospect of inheriting large quantities of abandoned Jewish property. In March of 1950, the Iraqi government gave official sanction to Jewish immigration, on the condition that the Jews applying for exit permits relinquish their Iraqi citizenship. And Iraq's Jews applied for immigration by the tens of the thousands. Baghdad granted permission for air transport, and the great airlift was dubbed Operation Ali Baba. It was launched on May of 1950. It's also known as Operation Ezra and Nehemiah. And here are some Iraqi Jews coming out of an El Al plane during Operation Ali Baba. Again, here's some more Jewish people exiting their aircraft. I put up the alternate name, Operation Ezra and Nehemiah. And of course, something had to be done with them. And so here is a transit camp that had been set up to deal with this huge influx of immigrants. And notice it's just a tent city. Israel had to throw together the best thing they could throw together during this time. And the best thing they could do at this time was a tent city for these people. But they seemed to be quite happy to be home from Iraq. Now, by the time the airlift ended in December of 1951, 113,000 passengers had been flown to the Jewish state. Afterward, smaller numbers of Jews reached Israel via Iran, bringing the total Iraqi immigration to 121,000. Then Jordan annexed the West Bank in 1950. Now, this is a map that I own. It's a pre-1967 map of Jordan. Now, on the back of the map, there's this overview map of Jordan showing its surrounding countries: Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq, Iran, Turkey, Syria and Arab Republic, Lebanon, and here is Jordan. Here is Jordan in the red. Now, let's take a little close-up look at that section of the map. Notice this little section of Jordan that is now protruding into Israel. That is the west bank of the Jordan River. Jordan held on to that territory during the war. And now in 1950, Jordan annexes this section of territory. It annexes the west bank of the Jordan River. And as you can see from this map, that area is considered part of the nation of Jordan. And note, there is no Palestinian state there. The West Bank now becomes part of Jordan. And by the way, Egypt did the same thing with the Gaza Strip, I believe. Anyway, there's no Palestinian state there. We now have the state of Jordan protruding into Israel. All right, 1951, the second Knesset is elected, and the tension on the borders increase. Now, this would be a good time for you to pull out the DVD, A Nation is Born, Volume 1, Program Number 2. This is by Foreign Minister Abba Eban. This show deals with, it's a 60-minute show. It deals with the time frame of 1948 to 1956. It deals with the War of Independence, the refugee crisis, both the Palestinian refugee crisis and the Jewish refugee crisis. It deals with the economic crisis. That's the refugee integration into Israel. That was a great economic struggle. And the acceptance crisis. Israel had to beg to join the UN, and Israel had to work with peace with her neighbors. So it's an interesting section dealing with the refugee, economic, and acceptance crises that Israel faced as a new and growing nation. Well, the immigration continued. And here is another transit camp, but you notice that Israel is improving their facilities for the immigrants. Here, it's no longer, this transit camp is no longer a tent city, but we have nice little temporary housing for the immigrants to come in. And this is an interesting DVD you might want to pick up as well. It's called The Forgotten Refugees, dealing with the immigration issue in Israel, if you want to focus in on that. All right, 1956. We'll move up a few years to 1956 and the Sinai Campaign. For the better part of two decades, from the summer of 1952 until the autumn of 1970, the history of the Arab world was largely dominated by one man, Egyptian President Gamal Abd al-Nasser. Nasser was the son of a post office employee in Upper Egypt. In his early youth, he was active in anti-British causes. The indignity of British rule was compounded by the military defeat by the Israelis. For Nasser and other military officers of his generation, this defeat, the Israeli debacle, or Palestinian debacle, whatever you want to call it, the defeat by the of the Egyptian forces, could be attributed less to Jewish steadfastness and courage than to the ineptitude and corruption of the Farouk regime. Now, Farouk was the last king of Egypt. He was dissolute and he was corrupt. Now, Nasser and his fellow conspirators, including Anwar al-Sadat, broadened their following within the officer corps and on July 23, 1952, seized control of Egypt's government in a bloodless coup, and King Farouk was out. Now, in March of 1954, Nasser replaced General Naguib as premier, and later he would assume the presidency. Now, Nasser singled out Israel as the target of his ambitions. In December of 1954, the Egyptian Minister of National Guidance announced that Egypt would never make peace with Israel. Now, these developments took place at a time of widespread German ex-Nazi participation in the Nasser government, as well as a campaign of Egyptian organized sabotage that was launched against Israel. Until then, Jordan had served as the principal base for marauding attacks over Israel's frontiers. Now, up until then, all the terrorist infiltration came from Jordan. But now, in 1954, leadership of the guerrilla campaign passed over to Egypt. And now Israel was faced with guerrilla infiltration along her southern and western border. By October, Fedayeen squads, trained and equipped by Egyptian army units, were penetrating deep into Israel. Roads, bridges, water pipes were mined, large quantities of equipment and livestock stolen. Soon the entire development plan in Israel's southern desert was threatened. Many of the settlers were leaving, and soon Israel found herself isolated. Now, in 1955, Nasser began exploring the possibilities of obtaining military equipment from the Soviet bloc. Moscow was entirely receptive. The Russians were prepared to exploit any opening to undermine Western influence in the Middle East. In August 1955, Nasser was allowed to purchase some $320 million worth of modern weapons from Czechoslovakia. The quantity of war material involved was unprecedented by Middle Eastern standards. It included 200 tanks, 150 military pieces, 120 MiG jet fighters, 50 jet bombers, 20 transport planes, 2 destroyers, 2 submarines, 15 minesweepers, plus hundreds of vehicles and thousands of modern rifles and machine guns. In a parallel treaty, Syria contracted with the Soviet bloc to purchase an additional 100 tanks, 100 MiG jet fighters, and hundreds of military pieces and armored vehicles. Now, on December 29, 1955, Russian Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev loosed a particularly tough blast against Israel. Moscow made no effort thereafter to disguise its hostility, repeatedly condemning the Jewish state in the Security Council and accusing Ben-Gurion of preparing for war against the Arabs. Under these bleak circumstances, the Israelis were reminded that the nation's security depended upon its own reserves. The nation's limited resources clearly dictated a military force based essentially upon reserves. So the Knesset enacted a comprehensive defense service law that established the legal foundation for Israel's citizen army. In the 1950s, mobilization had already become an integral part of Israel's everyday life. In short, every Israeli was a soldier, either on active or reserve status. Ben-Gurion's goal was nothing less than the transformation of Israel's defense branches into unified, compulsory, professional, and apolitical military machine. As premier and defense minister from 1947 to 1963, Ben-Gurion accomplished this task. Now, in December of 1953, Moshe Dayan was appointed chief of staff. Under his leadership, the army became a hard-fitting, aggressive force. For Dayan, the emphasis was on striking power. All planning was geared to surprise preemptive blows, a hard-driving, even reckless offensive aimed at breaking the enemy's morale. Dayan put his philosophy of aggressive retaliation to work almost immediately. With Ben-Gurion, he was determined to prove to the Arab states that the cost of marauding and killing Israelis was prohibitive. By the mid-1950s, the government's approach was to launch punitive expeditions against Arab villages harboring infiltrators and occasionally against Arab military strongpoints. Now, the raids did much for army morale and training. However, the cost in world opinion and in repeated UN censure was quite high. By 1953, the Egyptian Coast Guard, or I should say in 1953, the Egyptian Coast Guard unit as Ras Nasrani had closed off Israeli shipping through the Strait of Tiran. Now, let's take a look at the Strait of Tiran. Here's Israel in this area. And this is the Sinai Peninsula to the south. And the Strait of Tiran is at the very southern end of the Sinai Peninsula. And Israel, of course, is at the very northern end of the Gulf of Eilat there, Gulf of Eilat. Now let's take a look here. Here is a map of the Strait of Tiran. This is the route that the ships had to take, a very narrow, narrow little passageway up the Gulf of Aqaba, the Gulf of Eilat, to the city of Eilat, and of course the city of Aqaba. Aqaba is in Saudi Arabia, Eilat is in Israel. So that little stretch of water is sometimes called the Gulf of Aqaba or the Gulf of Eilat. But ships need to go up there to resupply and drop off their cargoes either in Aqaba on the Saudi Arabian side or in Eilat on the Israeli side. And they all have to go through that narrow, narrow little strait of water. And here you can see how narrow it is. Very narrow little passage of water for these ships. All right, in September of 1955, the Egyptians similarly turned back vessels of other nations that were bound for Israel's port of Eilat. The only ships allowed to go through were ships going to Aqaba. Now, Ben-Gurion, on October 22, 1953, ordered Dayan to make preparations for capturing the Strait of Tiran. Now, in 1955, Israel had managed not only to organize its defense establishment, but to also acquire some 200 tanks and some 200 planes. Most of these were obsolete British and American equipment and quite insufficient in quality and quantity. But the Czech arms deal threatened to give the Arabs a weapon superiority of 6-1. So France then became Israel's principal supplier of arms. And then Nasser issued his challenge. Ironically, the West's break with Cairo was precipitated by a matter related to the local Egyptian economy and its development, the Aswan High Dam on the Nile. In May 16, 1956, the Egyptian Foreign Ministry announced its recognition of Communist China. In the following month, Soviet Foreign Minister Dmitry Shapilov appeared in Cairo to offer an interest-free loan of $120 million. This sequence of events was too much for Washington. Nasser was clearly playing one side against the other, the East against the West. And in July 19, 1956, the United States retracted its offer of funds to help build the Aswan High Dam. Nasser had anticipated the Western reaction and intended to use the cancellation of the loan as his pretext for nationalizing the Suez Canal. Accordingly, on July 26, Nasser proceeded to drop his bombshell. The Suez Canal was being nationalized. Its future revenues would be applied to the construction of the Aswan Dam. Well, that night there was delirium in Egypt. Nasser was hailed as a national hero. His domestic position had never been more secure, nor his reputation in the Arab world ever higher. Britain was the most directly affected by this change of situation. Britain owned a controlling interest in the canal. Nearly a quarter of British imports passed through the canal, and one-third of the ships using the waterway were British. Now let's take a look at the Suez Canal. Here is a map, satellite picture. The Suez Canal links this narrow the stretch of land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Gulf of Suez. So let's go in a little closer. Here you can see the Suez Canal stretching between the Mediterranean in the north and the Gulf of Suez on the south. And here is a picture of an American task force transiting the canal. Very, very important little waterway. Now, the stake, too, was the Britain's general prestige in the Arab world. Not only were her ships having to pay now to go through the canal, but her general prestige in the Arab world was diminished. And so Britain was in no position to accept this affront. So at this point, both the French and British governments ordered their civilians evacuated from Egypt. Anglo-French military preparation gained momentum at that point in time. Britain and France brought the issue to the UN, The Soviets vetoed any meaningful resolution of censure against Egypt. As far as Britain and France were concerned, all peaceful recourse had been exhausted. And then, June 19th, Nasser made his intentions toward Israel clear in a public speech. "We must be strong in order to regain the rights of the Palestinians by force. We must be strong in order to regain the rights of the Palestinians by force." Abd al-Hakim Amer, the commander-in-chief of the Egyptian army, informed his troops on July 15th, "The hour is approaching when we will stand in the front ranks of the battle against imperialism and its Zionist ally." Ben-Gurion knew that he had to break the Egyptian blockade of the Strait of Tiran, and he only searched for a decisive moment to act. France supplied the opportunity. The French leadership was interested in a carefully structured two-pronged offensive against Nasser. An Israeli ground attack through Sinai would enable the British and the French to paratroop assault the canal zone itself. Now, on October 2, 1956, Diane revealed to his senior staff what was afoot. The purpose of the impending campaign was to wipe out the Egyptian army in Sinai, destroy the Fedayeen bases in the Gaza, and open up the Strait of Tiran. Now, the role Britain proposed for Israel initially was unacceptable. The first proposal was for the Israeli army to advance in great strength and on a broad front in the Sinai and mount a heavy attack that would threaten Cairo. It would be a real war, and the Allied forces would intervene as saviors of peace. Well, this was out of the question for Ben-Gurion. His aim was simply to clear the Egyptians out of Gaza and end the blockade of the Strait of Tehran. An advance on the canal, let alone Cairo, was the last thing in the Israeli prime minister's mind. Well, Diane counter-proposed that Israel would carry out a limited offensive, more than a raid, less than a war, an operation that would be interpreted as threatening the canal and justifying Allied intervention to safeguard it. So Britain and France accepted the Israeli plan. Israel would strike first on October 29th, dropping paratroopers east of the canal area, and would announce the operation over the radio. Britain and France would then address a joint ultimatum to Israel and to Egypt to cease military activity. Israel would accept, but would not be obligated to actually observe the ceasefire until its troops advanced to a line within 10 miles of the canal area. In fact, the Israelis would have 12 hours to reach that point. Egypt would most certainly reject the discriminatory Allied conditions. Now, at this point, British and French air forces would attack Egyptian airfields. They would destroy Nasser's planes on the ground, and that would remove all fear of Israeli cities being bombed, and simultaneously eliminate any threat against Anglo-French landings. Finally, Allied troops would land along the canal and seize the waterway. At that moment, the Hungarian Revolution broke out. It was suppressed by the invading Soviet forces, and that event claimed world attention. Ben-Gurion was convinced that the tumultuous events in Eastern Europe would totally absorb the diplomatic efforts of Washington and the UN Security Council, and there would never be a more opportune moment for Israel to attack. The operation was dubbed Operation Kadesh. At 3:30 p.m. on October 29th, the 202nd Paratroop Brigade under Colonel Ariel Sharon moved into the Sinai. As Operation Kadesh unfolded, the Israeli government was obligated to lift its veil of secrecy. From his bed, where influenza had prostrated him with a 103-degree temperature, Ben-Gurion approved the deceptive announcement early on October 30th. Israeli defense forces entered and engaged Fedayeen units in Ras al-Nakeb and Kintila, seized positions west of the Nahal crossroads in the vicinity of the Suez Canal. This action follows the Egyptian assaults on Israeli transport on land and seas, destined to cause destruction and denial of peaceful life to Israel's citizens. Just enough had been revealed to enable the British and French governments to fulfill their part of the scenario. On the afternoon of October 30th, the British and French handed notes to the Israeli and Egyptian ambassadors demanding that their forces withdraw respectively to points 10 miles east and west of the canal. Israel, as planned, accepted the Anglo-French ultimatum. From Cairo, the response was precisely the one Israel and the Western allies had anticipated. Despite panic-stricken entreaties of his generals, Nasser rejected the Allied demand. At 7 p.m. on October 31st, Allied jet squadrons began bombardment of Egyptian airfields near the canal. And here is a Royal Navy Hawker Seahawk about to be launched for a strike on an Egyptian airfield. Ultimately, 200 British and French fighter bombers operating from carriers and from bases in Malta and Cyprus swept back and forth over the Delta and canal fields, destroying the largest part of the Egyptian Air Force while it was on the ground. And here is a picture of Port Said during Operation Kadesh as it is under attack. It looks like perhaps an oil depot or something there burning furiously from all that smoke. Eventually, the British and French paratroopers did land and did secure the Suez Canal. And Israel swept across the Sinai on four fronts. In the north, the north central, the south central area, and the southern part of the border. So these are the Arab-Israeli assaults against the Arabs, against Egypt during Operation Kadesh. Now, in the initial stages of the war, the opposing forces had been roughly equal in size. However, the quality of Israeli manpower at all levels was far higher. The officers led imaginatively and bravely. They also suffered half the army's casualties. They allowed nothing to stop their advance. At the cost of 180 men killed and four captured, of 20 planes and some 2,000 worn-out vehicles, Israel, in essentially a 100-hour campaign, had occupied the whole of the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip. Israel had shattered three Egyptian divisions, killed 2,000 of the enemy, and taken nearly 6,000 prisoners. Israeli forces likewise captured war material valued at over $50 million, including 7,000 tons of ammunition, 500,000 gallons of fuel, 100 Bren carriers, 200 military pieces, 100 tanks, over 1,000 other vehicles, and an Egyptian frigate that had been trapped off of Haifa by a French destroyer and then rocketed into surrender by Israeli planes. And here is a picture, representative picture of the damaged Egyptian forces. Well, the world was outraged at Britain and France and Israel. On November 2nd, the General Assembly of the UN approved the United States resolution for an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal of all occupying forces from the Egyptian territory. On November 4th, the General Assembly voted to create the United Nations Emergency Force, the UNEF, which would separate the combatants along the Suez Canal and elsewhere in the Sinai. On November 4th, the Israeli government announced its willingness to accept the General Assembly ceasefire resolution. The acceptance was conditional on Egypt's declaration of willingness to, there's 6 points here. Egypt needed to be willing to, 1, accept the ceasefire, 2, end the state of war with Israel, 3, terminate all guerrilla operations, 4, enter into immediate peace negotiations with Israel, 5, cease the economic boycott of Israel, and 6, to lift the blockade against Israeli shipping. Initial UN efforts were aimed at extracting France and Britain. But finally, on December 22nd, the last British and French troops left the canal zone. A new General Assembly resolution on January 7th, 1957, demanded instant Israeli evacuation. And the Israelis pulled back grudgingly, and the UNEF forces filled the vacuum. On January 15th, Ben-Gurion announced his government's decision to evacuate Sinai completely by January 22nd, with the exception of the Sharm el-Sheikh area guarding the Strait of Tiran. And again, here is Israeli positions after Operation Kadesh. Here is our Strait of Tiran, where Israeli shipping was allowed to, or all shipping, could enter the Gulf of Eilat, the Gulf of Aqaba. This is the Sharm el-Sheikh positions, where the Israelis maintain control, and also they maintain control at Ras Nasrani. And here is an Israeli soldier standing next to an Egyptian gun that had blockaded the Tehran Straits. You can see the strait is very, very narrow there, and the artillery can easily shell any ships that try to pass through that area. So the Straits of Tiran remained under Israeli control, and the Gaza Strip would likewise remain under Israeli control. Eventually, a formula was devised that put the NEF, UNEF, into both Gaza and Sharm el-Sheikh. Now, the formula included assurance that both sites would be, Sharm el-Sheikh and Ras Nasrani, both sites would be garrisoned exclusively by the UNEF, that the UNEF would safeguard life and property in these two areas, and develop specific plans for coping with the refugee problem. The UNEF would remain in Gaza and Sharm el-Sheikh for whatever length of time was required to achieve a permanent settlement between Egypt and Israel. Now, one of Israel's most devoutly cherished hopes for Operation Kadesh would remain unrealized, and this was the fall of Nasser himself. The Egyptian dictator had emerged from his battlefield disaster with his prestige reasonably intact. He'd managed to camouflage the awful shellacking his army had suffered by the Israelis under the reasonable excuse, the reasonable evidence of Anglo-French bombardment and landings. So there was little question that the 100-hour campaign had fulfilled its principal goal of advancing Israel's security. It profoundly enhanced the morale of the Israeli people themselves, and the military lessons of the campaign, with its demonstrated advantages of preemptive attack, were invaluable. Fedayeen activity from Gaza virtually ended. Israelis in the outlying border settlements can now work and sleep in peace for the first time in 7 years. The Gulf of Aqaba was open and would stay open for 11 years. And these 11 years were all that was needed to establish Israel's trade relationships with the Orient and to inaugurate a series of pipelines that transformed the little republic into one of the major oil depots between Iran and Europe, and to develop an infrastructure that launched Israel on a period of its most impressive economic growth and diplomatic influence. So in November 1956, by a universal recognition, the Jewish state had established itself at last as a factor to be reckoned with, indeed a sovereign entity to be treated with prudence and respect in the councils of the nations. And please note, this defeat of Egypt, and coupled with the Arab desire for national pride and revenge, made the Six-Day War some 11 years later inevitable. All right, let's move to 1961 and Adolf Eichmann, tried and executed in Israel. May 23, 1960, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion made an electrifying announcement in the Knesset. I have to inform the Knesset that a short while ago, the Israeli Security Service captured one of the greatest war criminals, Adolf Eichmann, who together with the Nazi leaders was responsible for what was termed the final solution to the Jewish problem, that is, the destruction of 6 million European Jews. Eichmann is already in detention in Israel and will soon be put to trial here under the Nazi and Nazi collaborators punishment law of 1950. The words were received with incredulous silence. Several moments passed before the listeners grasped the full import of Ben-Gurion's words. And then slowly the members of the Knesset rose to their feet in a sustained ovation of applause and cheering. The announcement culminated one of the most extraordinary manhunts in recent history. The search for the SS officer who had directed the Jewish section of Nazi Germany's Reich Main Security Office, and who, in that capacity, had presided over a major phase of the final solution, Adolf Eichmann. After the war, Eichmann had eventually made his way to Buenos Aires under a passport bearing the name Ricardo Clement. And here's a picture of his passport to Buenos Aires, Argentina. In 1952, he felt confident enough to send for his family. The children, who had been small when their father left them some years earlier and had been informed that he was dead, were told that this was Uncle Ricardo. Consequently, Eichmann married their mother and she became Mrs. Clement. In 1952, he joined the automobile firm of Mercedes-Benz to which he was openly introduced and openly recommended as SS Lieutenant Colonel Adolf Eichmann in retirement. He was sure by then that the search for him had ended, nor was he entirely wrong. The official pursuit, indeed, was over, but there were other hunters. These were the survivors of the Nazi death camps. One of them, Simon Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal had founded a documentation center in Vienna immediately after the war, and he made it his life's purpose to track down the Nazi criminals. It was Wiesenthal who managed finally to secure a rare picture of Eichmann. Wiesenthal continued to pursue every scrap of information. Eventually, Eichmann was confirmed to be living in Buenos Aires. It was decided to kidnap him and bring him to Israel. On May 11, 1960, he was accosted and spirited away to an isolated villa where he confessed his identity. On May 14th, he was drugged and transported to Israel. And here's a book you might enjoy reading covers this in detail, Hunting Eichmann. It's available on Amazon.com. It goes through all the ins and outs of capturing and transporting Eichmann to Israel. On May 23rd, Ben-Gurion made his announcement, first to the cabinet, then to the Knesset. On that very day, the very day the announcement was made, Eichmann was arraigned before a magistrate in Jaffa. There he was charged with crimes against the Jewish people, war crimes against humanity, and membership in a criminal organization, 15 counts in all. Eichmann was then returned to Ramla prison. The only country to demand Eichmann's return was Argentina. All other countries, in one way or another, expressed their conviction that Israel would handle the Eichmann case fairly and justly. This expectation was fulfilled to a degree that surprised even the prisoner. The Israeli authorities allowed him to choose his own counsel from any nation of his own preference. At the suggestion of his family, he picked Dr. Robert Servatius, a distinguished 65-year-old lawyer on the Cologne bar who had acquired experience in defending war criminals at the Nuremberg trials. Servatius was allowed to bring an assistant counsel with him. The Israeli government paid all expenses and fees. The trial began on April 11, 1961, in Beit Am, a large public auditorium in Jerusalem. Attorney General Gideon Hausner began his introductory address on April 17th. It was an eight-hour statement. And the eight-hour statement included these words, "As I stand before you, judges of Israel, I do not stand alone. With me in this place and in this and at this hour stand 6 million accusers." And here's a picture of Eichmann on trial. The prosecution cross-examined, submitted vast quantities of its own documentation, and presented innumerable Jewish and occasional non-Jewish witnesses to testify to their ordeal and that of the Jewish people during the Holocaust. So here's some pictures of the Eichmann trial. Eichmann on trial. Here's his trial judges, Benjamin Halevi, Moshe Landau, Yitzhak Rave. And Israel Gutman testifying at Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem 1961. I would assume he is a Holocaust survivor, along with Abba Kovner, he testifying at Eichmann's trial in Jerusalem in 1961. The audience listened in horror, many times breaking into tears, some fainting. In his defense, Eichmann endlessly minimized his role. On August 14, 1961, after 114 sessions, the main proceedings came to an end. The court then adjourned for 4 months, and then reassembled on December 11th to pronounce judgment. Eichmann was convicted on all 15 counts of the specific indictment. On December 15th, Eichmann was sentenced to death. Eichmann appealed the verdict, and his case was brought to the Supreme Court in May of 1962. This time, the hearings were completed in 6 sessions. On May 29th, the lower court verdict was sustained. Eichmann then appealed to the President of Israel. At 8 p.m. on the following day, May 31st, Eichmann was informed that his petition for mercy had been refused and that the execution would take place at midnight. At the gallows, he refused the black hood, and he sent greetings to Germany, Austria, and Argentina and to his wife and family. "I had to obey the rules of war and my flag," he declared, just before the trap was sprung. Eichmann's body was cremated, and in the small hours of June 1st, his ashes were carried aboard a police launch. When the vessel reached the territorial three-mile limit, the prisons commission dropped the ashes overboard. And in 1995, a follow-up quote, this is a follow-up quote to this whole incident that appeared in 1995 in the Jerusalem Report. Middle East archaeology professor Ricardo Eichmann, 40-year-old son of Adolf Eichmann, hanged in Israel in 1962 in an interview with a German newspaper. He said, "I hate the Nazis, and I'm glad my father is not with us now. When I think about the suffering he caused, then I would say, yes, his punishment was justified." All right, well, that brings us to the end of our time this session. We'll pick it up next session in 1964 with the creation of the National Water Carrier. So thanks for being our students for this session. We'll pick it up next session. I hope you're able to join us. Again, thanks for joining us. Lehi Thraod. Lehi Thraod.